when you do create a lot of content, and especially when you become full-time like I did, it can be something that can lead to a little bit of burnout because you start to become so dependent on, is this going to go viral? And you can't control the outcomes, right? And so I've really had to reprogram myself to focus on, I can only control the inputs, not the outputs. So I could control the consistency of my input and the quality of my input and like the thoughtfulness and whatever, and really engage the community and have that two-way dialogue with them. And so those are the things you can control. Yes, the variance leads to potentially burnout. Every creator, I think, if you create content long enough, eventually reaches some form of burnout, and then you have to figure out how to mitigate that. And I think one way to do that is to always shift the focus to, doesn't need to go viral to have an impact, right? Like, I actually think it's a stronger long-term strategy to not just chase the views, the virality, but instead cultivate really deep, engaged relationships with your core community, because they're going to follow you everywhere. They're going to want to meet you, and they're going to be down for anything that you put out. And that is, I think, a better strategy for sustainability, because it's hard to be sustainable as a creator.
In less than 2 years, Doma's gone from relative obscurity to one of the premier thought leaders in the direct-to-consumer space. With a TikTok that's got over 100,000 fans and growing, and a podcast that's in the top 2.5% in the world. I had a fantastic time with her. She's a friend I met on Twitter. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Remember, if you do, be a friend, tell a friend. Thanks.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. Today, I've got Doma Alton on the show today. Welcome to the show, Doma.
I'm so excited to be here.
And Doma, I think you are the first person on the show that I officially met via Twitter, I think, or at least that was how we built our relationship initially. So fun to have that happen.
Yeah, that was fun. And then we met in person at the Information Summit, which was awesome. So,
yeah, no, it was a good one. Well, there's a lot to cover today. You've been incredibly successful. I had to condense down the questions quite a bit. But just for those that don't know you, I want to start with one question on your history, right? Which is, you got the bug to be an entrepreneur in 2017, it's about 5-6 years ago, and then really became a creator about 2 years ago. I'd love to know, what made you decide to become an entrepreneur and then a creator? Is this what you're going to do for the rest of your life, right? Number two. And then number three, maybe describe what your channel is a little bit, just so people have a good feel for it.
So I think even in college and undergrad, I knew I wanted to do something entrepreneurial. I really liked the idea of being creative, creating something from scratch that could have an impact, also not having a boss. So I think I was drawn to all of those things, typical millennial. But I wanted to gain a little bit more experience in the quote unquote real world first, hence why I took my first job at Google and then worked with different startups after that and then started my own fragrance business. So I think even before 2017, which is when I started my first business, a clean fragrance store, I knew I wanted to eventually get there, but I kind of wanted to build some experience first, build up my resume. And also, I wanted to wait before starting a business because I wanted to make sure the idea was something I could really get behind, instead of doing that thing where you go, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to play the startup sort of founder game. So I'm going to try to come up with an idea. I didn't really feel compelled to do that because I'm somebody who needs to feel really jazzed by something to have the motivation to do it. So that's kind of the timeline of how I got into entrepreneurship. How I became a creator was sort of by accident. I call myself an accidental TikTok creator because in September of 2021, I was basically full-time bootstrapping my second business, which was a private community of nearly 2,000 women D2C founders with a membership and masterminds and all these different workshops and courses we would put together by bringing in outside experts like, you know, Nick Sharma or Taylor Holiday or different founders. And I was working on that, and this was around the time that everybody was panicking about iOS 14. So my community was asking, does anyone know how to use TikTok as an acquisition channel? Because at the time, it was still pretty fresh, pretty new. And I couldn't find anybody to teach TikTok for e-commerce or for acquisition specifically. People were just getting the hang of TikTok, even as consumers. And so I thought, why don't I just roll up my sleeves and start posting? And it was also a fun challenge for me to be like, I'm going to post every day for 100 days because I happen to be really afraid of putting myself out there and putting myself on video, which is so ironic because it's all I do now. But I was terrified. So for anybody out there who feels like, oh, that could never be me, you would be surprised at, you know, just how much of a little push it takes to get over that fear. So that was what I started doing. And then 3 weeks into it, and I, by the way, I had been posting a couple times a day for 3 weeks, which in the scheme of things is not that much, but it's so funny because I became so demoralized because I was like, why is nothing going viral? Because I was so entitled. And also TikTok, you know, it just seemed like everything was popping off left and right. And I was like, why are none of my videos popping off? And then I pivoted to talking about, so one thing I had wanted to create content about, but I didn't think it would be on TikTok was, oh, I follow all this business news. I consume all this business content. I listen to all these business podcasts, but most of the stories are spotlighting men, men in tech, men in business. And I'm always like hunting for the stories about women. Even when I would listen to How I Built This, it would be the Tatcha story that would be really inspiring to me. So I was like, why don't I create more of that content? And then I realized, wait, I can just do that on TikTok. It would make it actually a lot easier because it's just so seamless to create content on TikTok. So as soon as I started doing that, and then I combined it with the Kardashians because I was like, how can I make people interested in the business side of things? It went viral. To this day, that first video that I did around that, the first few videos, the second video that I posted with that theme is the one that I've done that has the most views, like 2.3 million. And I haven't surpassed that with my other videos, even the ones that performed really well. So that's kind of how I got into that. And then I just kept going. And I never thought like, oh, I'm going to be an influencer. I'm going to be a creator. I'm going to make all this money. That was not on my radar at all. I just thought, oh my gosh, this is working. I don't know what to do other than to keep going and just hang on for dear life. And then I started getting a lot of organic press, like Morning Brew did a profile on me, Glossy, like eventually The Information. And then I got invited to speak on panels. And I met a lot of interesting people, especially because I talked about creator-led brands and celebrity brands a lot. I met a lot of their teams and I got followed by a lot of, you know, celebrities. And so I was like, there's something here, but God knows what it's going to become. But then a few months later, I got my first brand deal. So then I just kept going and eventually went full time.
Yeah, it's weird how you stumble into those things. I guess the kind of last question is this your career? Is this going to be? And again, who knows what's going to happen in 10 years. Right. But as you look, say, 3 years out, 5 years out, is this the plan for a while?
You know, I really love creating content and I've tried on a lot of different hats, right? I've worked at a big company. I've worked at a startup. I've had my own businesses. So I've tried different things on for size. I spent most of my 20s just kind of experimenting, which at the time I felt clueless and like I kept wandering. But now I feel like I've gathered a lot of data about myself and what I'm a good fit for. And I really do think that I love creating content because what I love is I love the feeling of I've stumbled upon an insight or I've uncovered some interesting tidbit and I'm sharing it with people in a way that's impactful for them or moves the needle for them. And that can be about anything, but for now it's about business. But I really love doing that. It almost, to me, feels like I've figured out a way to get paid to be this like scholar of the things that I find interesting. And I'm such a nerd and I loved academics, but I hate the structure of like regular academia. So for me, this is perfect. So I'm like, yeah, I could definitely do this for a while. And the platforms might change, the formats might change and diversify and evolve. But I love doing this and I'm in it for the long haul.
You know, it's funny. I started doing this as well, right? Not to the degree that you do, but I was like, I'm going to start publishing and see what happens. This is, I think, in January. So like 4 or 5 months ago. And the impacts are wild, right? Like I'm getting five times the reach of our company channels, which have significantly more followers. I've been doing this for years. But to your point on the getting paid to do research side of things, like in order to create interesting content, I have to dive in and find something that is interesting, right? But it ends up providing so much material for me as I have other conversations. Like I reference so much of what I'm creating when I'm talking to someone and it gets referenced so much internally by our team now, like in their conversations, that it's fascinating, right? It's this total side benefit that occurs, which is hard. It's hard to create good, interesting content on a consistent basis. I love that side benefit of it.
Totally. And also I have been surprised at how much you can glean when you really do a deep dive onto a founder or a creator or a brand company versus even if you spend a lot of time consuming a lot of random Twitter business content or news, business news, right? Or if you're reading Bloomberg and, you know, Wall Street Journal or whatever, you get bits and pieces, but you're never able to really, really go that deep because it's just this breadth, but not always a lot of depth. But when you intentionally choose to do a deep dive on a few of the biggest players in a specific industry, in my case, it would be D2C, you actually end up learning so much more and connecting a lot more dots than you would be able to otherwise. That is the most rewarding part of the pursuit, because you're just able to see so much that other people don't see, even if they're in the industry, because not everybody has time to spend a week learning about Glossier. So
exactly. Well, and that's also why people want to follow the videos, want to read your content, etc. It's like doing this interview with you, right? I'm spending a few hours looking at your content, listening to your podcasts, etc. And now there's no way I could consume all of them. There's way too much stuff, but you get a lot of depth there. Let's talk about your channels a little bit, right? So what you find with most creators is that there's a small number of channels where they really focus because of their audience, because of the type of content they have, etc. For you, that's TikTok, Twitter, and podcasts. It feels like those are the three channels. I'm feeling like we should lead off with TikTok, mostly because that's one where you've got the biggest audience. It's where you got a lot of specialization. So one of the things I'd like to dive into there is what you mentioned on our first video got 2.3 million views, and I've never even really gotten back there, right? And if you look at TikTok, you have this much wider variance in performance of content. And I actually mapped your content. So it's like 80% of your videos were in the thousands of views. 18% of them, so it's 35, if you were to look at the last 200, 18% were in the tens of thousands, 2% were in the hundreds of thousands or more. So talk to me about, like, from an emotional and mental perspective, the challenge there, right? It feels like you're kind of like hunting for gold, you're mining for gold, you're looking for these nuggets. How do you cope with that? What are the challenges there of, like, not knowing how a particular video is going to do?
I think this variance in performance is to some extent an attribute of social media in general and of these content platforms, but I think it's a lot more exaggerated on TikTok because the variance is a lot higher. It's a lot more unpredictable sometimes, it feels. And basically every other creator I've talked to, and a lot of my friends are creators at this point, they all sort of like have some version of, oh, sometimes I'll do a throwaway video, it'll get millions of views, and sometimes I'll spend days or even weeks on a video and it'll flop. And I think we've all experienced that, and it's so exasperating, it's so frustrating. It feels like banging your head against a wall because you think you figured out the formula and then it doesn't work. And so that can be frustrating. It can also incentivize you to keep creating content, which is why I think TikTok almost gamifies that experience a little bit. It's like being at, you know, when you get off your plane at the Vegas airport and you just walk in and just like slot machines everywhere. And like when you walk into a casino, there are like people who are like zombies just like pulling on the slot machine. And you're like, have you had water in the last 10 hours? So that's sometimes, okay, well, this is not very inspiring for anyone who's thinking of creating TikTok content, but
it's a good way to limit your competition.
Yeah, exactly. It's all strategic. But you know, when you do create a lot of content, and especially when you become full-time like I did, it can be something that can lead to a little bit of burnout because you start to become so dependent on, is this going to go viral? And you can't control the outcomes, right? And so I've really had to reprogram myself to focus on, I can only control the inputs, not the outputs. And so I'm going to try to control the inputs. And as far as, you know, these days I'm creating more podcast content and I'm on Twitter more, so I'm less consistent on TikTok, to be honest. But you know, in the beginning I was super consistent and I was publishing at least one video a day, and a lot of research went into them. So that was no small feat. So I could control the consistency of my input and the quality of my input and like the thoughtfulness and whatever, and really engage the community and have that two-way dialogue with them. And so those are the things you can control. So I think, yes, the variance leads to potentially burnout. Every creator, I think, if you create content long enough, eventually reaches some form of burnout. And then you have to figure out how to mitigate that and how to manage that and how to not quite fall into that trap. And I think one way to do that is to always shift the focus to, doesn't need to go viral to have an impact, right? Like, especially once you build that community who loves your content anyway, they're going to be seeing your stuff that doesn't pop and they're going to really appreciate that. And so I think not only does that help with the mental health side of being a creator, but honestly, I actually think it's a stronger long-term strategy to not just chase the views, the virality, but instead cultivate really deep, engaged relationships with your core community, because they're going to follow you everywhere. They're going to want to meet you and they're going to be down for anything that you put out. And that is, I think, a better strategy for sustainability, because it's hard to be sustainable as a creator.
Yeah, it's a thousand true fans model, right? Like where exactly. You just have much deeper relationships that are more valuable rather than surface level relationships. Yep. So you talked about community building there. What is that for you? Like when you say community building, what does that mean?
It's almost like really knowing who your audience is and having that sort of like avatar in mind for who you're creating for, who's sort of the archetypal follower that you have and that you enjoy creating content for. Who is that person? How can you create content for their needs and what they're thinking about and what's maybe keeping them up at night or what's entertaining to them or what's funny to them or inspiring to them or informational for them? So I think it's creating content for them and also maintaining that two-way dialogue with them. Like you kind of referenced before, I'm not very active on Instagram as far as posting to the feed or whatever, but I do have a lot of like conversations in the DMs with my followers because it's harder to have that on TikTok just because of the way it's designed. And so my 1,000 true fans, or a couple thousand of them, have followed me over at Instagram and I talk to them all the time. And I often joke that the best way to get a response from me on any platform, no matter who you are in my life, is to DM me on Instagram because I'm very bad at responding to texts. I'm very bad at responding to email. I'm bad at basically every kind of response on the internet other than Instagram DMs because that's where my followers ask me the most questions, give me the most feedback. And so I like really love having that conversation with them. And so I think it's just about that and like the ripple effect of that. And then they'll share my stuff with like their followers or their friends or whatever. So I think it's that two-way dialogue. And I also think it's really being clear on who you're creating content for instead of just creating for the algorithm, like creating for a person and like creating for the person who is representative of your typical audience instead of just, you know, how can I go viral? Because you can do that. And I know creators who have millions of followers on TikTok, but not a lot of quality and not really a core community. And also their niche is kind of all over the place. So it's harder for them to create a business out of that. Whereas I'm followed by like half of the women who work in D2C and like a very specific core community. So,
well, the consistency there, right? They know what they're coming to you for. They know what you're about. They know what they're going to learn from you, right?
Yeah.
And so I also think this two-way dialogue, obviously it occurs in the DMs, which I think the DMs are a fascinating concept in that it feels like they're replacing text messages for a lot of people, right? Like it's fascinating to see that become the primary messaging platform for a lot of people. But I think both the private interactions, but also the public interactions, right? Like I think one of the bigger missed opportunities is like, it takes a lot to put yourself out there, to your point earlier. And so if I go onto a creator's photo and make some comment, like most people don't do that often. And so when they do and you interact with it, it's a really special moment as well. And I think you do a good job of that. So you talked earlier about like, you feel like you figured it out and you put something out and it doesn't work. But you know, you got a general direction. So for you, in terms of general direction, we'll focus TikTok first here. What type of content do you feel like really works well? Mm-hmm. And frankly, for me, I don't do any short form video creations. It's a little bit of a mystery for me. So what would you say is special about short form video? Like what are the tips and tricks that you think work really well for creating good short form video content?
Have one main idea per video or one punchline, one general concept. Have a really strong hook. Get enough reps in that you understand what a good hook is and what that looks like for you. A little bit of clickbait, not too much. little bit.
Well, I think Mr. Beast calls it like, you have to have clickbait, but then you have to live up to the promise, right?
Oh, so
you have
to like, good.
Yeah. Like you can have the clickbait, but then you have to deliver on the clickbait. Like you have to actually do what it says.
Yeah, I mean, he's truly the master of that. But it's interesting you bring up Mr. Beast because when you start to talk to YouTubers at the top of their game, you realize just how much time they spend trying to A/B test and land upon the right thumbnail image, right? Like it's so all important and it's become this science. I mean, Mr. Beast has really turned YouTube content creation into a science. And the equivalent of that for short form video, whether it's TikTok or Shorts or whatever, is that first like 2 to 3 seconds, like three max. Like you really need to hook somebody. And there are little ways to do that, but it really depends on the kind of content you create. I mean, you can make use of text overlay for that. You can just have a compelling hook. Sometimes I like to do what I call leading with the punchline, but phrasing the punchline in a way that's kind of evocative and interesting and kind of leaves them hanging a little bit. And so they have to watch all the way through. So my favorite when I'm able to do it is to come up with like a different name or like a weird, like interesting insight for something and then lead with that. And then that intrigues people. And then you kind of, it's almost like you lead with the thesis, so to speak. And then the rest of the video supports your thesis. That can work, especially if you provide any kind of educational or informational content, which a lot of people increasingly do via short form video. So yeah, the hook is really important. One main idea I think works well, being consistent about your format, which I'm not very good at, but is actually something that you should do. Do as I say, don't do as I do. But I do think that on TikTok especially, and they're probably never going to admit this, but I really do think that once your account has a few videos that go viral that have a certain kind of consistent format, when you try to veer away from that format, the algorithm dings you a little bit. It really likes when you stick to that format. For me, it's like the green screen, talking about business, and I can churn out a lot of that. But lately, I've been trying to diversify a little bit, and it's been hard because you can tell the algorithm like is trying to, you know, disincentivize
like
you from
move you back that direction. Yeah.
It's like really like keeping you in your lane. But going back to this idea of you have to make it sustainable for yourself as a creator and you can't burn out, a lot of creators, especially on platforms like TikTok or whatever, they end up getting really boxed into a certain sort of niche and then they want to diversify from their niche and it's harder to. But I think if your aim is longevity as a creator, then I do think it's actually good to resist the urge to just do what the algorithm is rewarding you for, because you're going to box yourself in a very narrow way. And also the other thing is like once something starts to work, there are a lot of people who are going to start to copy that format and that style. And that's happened for me. Like nobody was doing these, you know, let's do a brand breakdown. Let's do a case study. Here's a green screen. Let's talk about D2C brands or like women in business or whatever. Nobody was really doing that before because TikTok was still kind of nascent as a platform. But now there are a lot of accounts that do that. And it's awesome. And it's amazing that there's so much great educational content out there. But for me, strategically, it feels a little bit like, okay, that's starting to get a little saturated. How can I diversify away from that? And even if it's harder in the short run, I think if you get really clear on this is the person I'm talking to, and this is who she is, this is what she needs, and these are all the different facets of what she's concerned about, I think that can be an interesting sort of like different way to think about it.
So there's this silly series on TikTok called Roll for Sandwich. And I've like followed it since very early on. And, you know, they roll for bread, roll for this. And he ends up eating these weird sandwiches or whatever. And my kids and I watch it, right? Really enjoy it. And it's funny because I've been watching him for a long time now. And you can see, like, you go to his account and like the Roll for Sandwich videos will get 5 million views. And his other videos will get like 100,000, right? It's like a 50x difference. And to your point, it's the algorithm rewarding that content and not rewarding others, right? As well as, frankly, as a consumer, that's what I know him for, right? And like, that's what I look to him for. And when he goes out of that, it's like, I don't know. Is this what I'm looking for? I'm not sure. So let's switch channels now. So let's talk about Twitter a little bit. And again, did a little research on you here. And what's interesting for me is Twitter is a much smaller audience for you. Right? It's only about 8,000 followers, but you've put out 2.5 times as many tweets as TikTok videos. And that's just tweets, not including replies, right? If you include replies, it's probably much bigger. And oddly enough, and I did this by hand, I wish I had a more sophisticated way to do this, but you got close to 4 times or over 4 times as many views on that content as you did on your TikTok content, despite TikTok having, you know, over 100,000 followers. I'm really curious for you, what made you decide to invest in Twitter so much outside of just pure interest? Because it isn't a channel that's super easy to like monetize either. And then what has been the impact for you from Twitter, right? How has it impacted your career?
Great question. And I do feel very exposed because I do spend way too much time on Twitter now. So thanks for
having me. You're there all the time. But I tell you what, it keeps you top of mind for me, right? Like I interact with the content sometimes, but it's like when there are people that are on Twitter all the time, you just see them all the time and they're just top of mind all the time, right? So I'm like just thinking about you. It's like, oh, we've got an event. We should bring Dolma in as a speaker. Oh, we got this thing. I need to invite a speaker. Let's invite Dolma, right? Like,
yeah.
Anyways,
okay, well, that's good to hear. That's kind of how I ended up like deciding to go to VidCon, because I posted like a throwaway tweet about like, oh, I'm not going to VidCon, but I'll be in LA. And one of my followers messaged me and she was like, hey, I've been loving your content for a while. I have this spare ticket for the industry track at VidCon. Do you actually want to go? I'll just transfer it to your name. And I was like, wait, this is amazing. Sometimes it's really nice to just like put random stuff out there. It doesn't always have to be so thought out. So the reason I got on Twitter is because I started a podcast several months ago, and my friend Danny Miranda, who's an incredible podcaster, since he got started, he's been getting such heavy hitters on his podcast. And I'm like, Danny, how do you do it? And people are always incredulously telling him like, wait, I thought your podcast was bigger because you have all these like famous people and like big names, but you're still kind of getting started, which I think for him, it's inevitable that he's going to be huge. But I was asking him, how do you get these big names? And he was like, honestly, Twitter is super helpful. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go on Twitter. And I've never been active on Twitter until a few months ago or until kind of recently because of that. And so I was testing it out. And then I realized, wait, it is actually so surprisingly easy to connect with awesome people on Twitter, because in the scheme of things, like tech Twitter, D2C Twitter, it's not that big. It's like a handful of people that you see all the time, and sometimes you see way too much. And maybe I'm in that camp. But I was like, wow, it's actually really helpful for landing great podcast guests. So that was part of it. So going back to my overall, like, do I think about being a creator long term? How do I think about TikTok versus podcast versus Twitter? My long game is the podcast. And yep. I really want to double down on that. I love long form content. I love doing this. It's just so much more fulfilling for me, honestly. And short form video is great top of funnel, right? But you know, if I want to double down on the podcast, then what does that look like? I need to be on Twitter. I need to be connecting with people on Twitter. I need to be thinking about what content does well on the podcast and then trying to reverse engineer the TikTok, which is why I've been kind of diversifying my TikTok content lately, even if the algorithm is kind of dinging me for it, because I do a combination of things on my podcast. And it's interesting because my solo episodes and my interviews get roughly the same downloads and listens, but the feedback that I get on the solo episodes are an order of magnitude more enthusiastic, more grateful, more positive. People are like, oh, I loved your interviews and I learn a lot from them. But with the solo episodes, I mean, it's just so different. So I realized, oh, I need to double down on that. So now I need to start posting about more of that kind of content on TikTok. My TikTok strategy increasingly and my Twitter strategy, even though it seems basically like I'm mostly shit posting, is they're both designed strategically to amplify the podcast and to like support the podcast. And it has been really helpful for that. I love Twitter a little too much. So
what's funny is we started this podcast 2 years ago and have only done interviews. And our team had asked me like, hey, we kind of want you to like go on and just talk, just like, yeah. You know, give your opinions, et cetera. And I had resisted it. And in preparation for this interview, I listened to a few of yours, listened to the one reflecting on the 100 episodes in 100 days or whatever. And it was great. Like, it was really nice to just listen to you talk. So maybe we should be doing that more.
Yeah. Cause in a way, you don't really get that sort of like pure form of like the host's mind and their thoughts and their perspectives, unless it's a solo episode, right? You kind of get it in bits and pieces, but when you're interviewing someone, you're spotlighting them. And I think if they like a podcast, they probably like the host because there are so many podcasts out there in every niche. So yeah. They probably like you. So that makes sense to me.
What's your process for writing like a solo episode?
So
like how much of it are you actually writing out? Cause you know, they're lengthy, right? 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll record for an hour and chop it down to like 30 minutes. This is another one of those do as I say, don't do as I do things where I am not necessarily good at planning out content, especially the solo episodes. I'll have a high level idea. Maybe I'll make like a very short outline of like, these are all the points I don't want to miss. But otherwise, I'm not very good at scripting something out. I certainly don't script things out. I don't really outline in great detail. Sometimes I'll have a certain outline and then I'll go in a different direction, especially because the solo episodes, I want like for me, those are just a way to share myself and they feel intimate, right? Like any kind of solo episode with any host that you listen to a lot, they tend to feel very personal and very intimate. And so for me, it is a little bit more conversational and I don't necessarily plan them out too much, but I think it's also a function of I talk about the things that I think about a lot. So I kind of have a sense of what I'm going to say. I don't need to do that much prep. I can kind of just like go off the cuff. But I think if it were like the very first episode I ever published was like this big deep dive into Glossier. And that was like a very laborious undertaking because I had to research so much for it. And I had already done a ton of research, but creating a 3-minute video is different than creating like an hour long episode. So it took actually weeks of research. But yeah, for that kind of thing, it would be different. So I think it just depends on what the focus is.
Okay, let's talk about your podcast, Natural yeah. Transition. So you started out with the ambitious plan of doing 100 episodes in 100 days, which I mean, I can't imagine anything more stressful. you know, we went from like an episode every other week to one a week, and that was like a big lift. One a day, including weekends, it like numbs my brain. So what made you, let's just talk about that first 100 days. Give me the idea of what your life was like during that period, what the challenges were, what you learned from that. I know you lost your laptop at one point. Give us the whole spiel.
It was a whole thing. Yeah. A lot of caffeine went into it, honestly. Just mountains and mountains of caffeine and sometimes espresso martinis. So I wanted to do that because from the beginning of my TikTok days, I'd started to get requests to do a podcast, especially because my TikTok content kind of lends itself well to extension through a format like podcast. And because of that, I'd been noodling on the idea for a while, but I was kind of paralyzed because I wanted it to be perfect and I was scared and I don't know. I had all these like hangups about it. And I think that's common when you are thinking of diving into a new project or a new platform, can be a little daunting. So I was sitting on it for a while, and then I published that Glossier episode and it got shared and people were so enthusiastic about it. And then I got scared. And then I was also like, wow, this took a lot of time for a single episode. So I don't know if I want to do this format anymore. So I sat on it for a few more months. And then like by the end of the year, sometime in December, my friends were asking me, especially my creator friends, they were like, hey, where's that podcast? Where's episode two? Like, are you ever going to publish episode two?
And there's a public record, right? People can see when you miss. They're like, oh, totally. You didn't publish for a few weeks. Like, what's going on?
I know, you really can't hide from that. And so I was being lovingly held accountable by some of my friends, which I really appreciate, especially Danny Miranda, who I mentioned already. And so I thought, you know what? Like, I am always so gung-ho about, you just have to go for it. Don't get stuck in perfectionism. And so I need to walk my own talk, which I hate doing, but I had to. So I decided to do a 100-day challenge. And that's kind of like the thing that I maybe am sometimes known for, because I do a lot of these 100-day challenges. I did a YouTube one, I did a podcast one, I did a fitness one, and that was really actually great for getting me into shape. And then I was like, this would be a bit of a stretch. This would be hard, the hardest one in some ways, but what if I did one for the podcast? Because I'm nuts.
I think that might be like the hardest. I mean, like, they have like the, was it 100-day hard? I'm like, I don't know, man. I've done podcasts and I'm not even doing the production of the podcast, and it's like, I can't imagine.
Yeah. And I was editing all of them by myself, and I was like doing, you know, all the research, and like, it is a big lift. But here's the other thing. It is a lot of work, but at the same time, I'm a full-time content creator, right? And I slowed down my TikTok content creation a lot. So if you're basically doing mostly that, it is doable. It's rare that anybody would be crazy enough to like set aside everything and just do that. But I also figured I want to get enough reps in. I think also somebody mentioned to me, oh, I got Seth Godin onto my podcast, and his whole thing is he's not going to say yes to an interview request unless somebody has 100 episodes in the archives. And I was like, well, then that's probably true of other guests too. So I'll just get the reps in. And I'm a masochist. And so it was fun. It was hard. And it was fun.
What's funny is we actually named our company after a Seth Godin book. So it's a book called Tribes and Tribe Dynamics. And now we're Creator IQ. But how did you get distribution? I mean, you mentioned that you're using your other channels to kind of funnel traffic. Imagine you're doing, you know, recaps and, hey, if you want more, go to the podcast or whatever. But you're now top 2.5% of all podcasts globally, according to Listen Notes. So what were some of your channels for acquisition? How did you get people to actually listen?
I would say the TikTok just really helped. It's funny because I have really not promoted the podcast a lot on my TikTok. If anything, if I talk about podcasts, it's here are other podcasts I love, because I get asked about my recommendations a lot. I think people just generally look to me for that content, more sort of like intellectual fodder. So I think in a way, my niche and my audience were primed to want more long form audio content from me. I think that helped certainly. I have this whole archive of all these videos that I haven't like chopped up and like turned into clips and distributed everywhere. I haven't done that yet. Yeah, I know I'm supposed to.
Same.
And I feel, and I'm like, oh, I'm such a bad podcast.
You're sitting on this like treasure trove. There's like so much stuff.
I know
there, right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. And I'm like, wow, this is really great content that I don't have time to edit. Yeah. I think it's just been the TikTok. Like the few times that I did share on TikTok helped. And then even though I don't have a lot of followers on Instagram, a lot of my followers there are quite engaged with me and they share my stuff a lot. So that has also helped. I think it's also just, I end up talking about a lot of like D2C founders and creators who have businesses. And they tend to be people, both of those categories actually, tend to be people with a good amount of followers on social media. And so when I do an interview with them and then they share, that helps.
Yep.
So I don't know. I really haven't hit the gas that hard with promotion, but so far it's been pretty good. So I'm excited to see what will happen once I actually start to promote the podcast.
Totally. One of the things we've found that's pretty powerful is like SEO, right? So for a lot of these people, like Google really values YouTube videos, they value podcasts, you know, long form content, whatever. And you'll find that for a lot of our guests, like it's showing up on the first page of Google when people search for them. Although they might have a large following and they share and that impacts, I think the SEO is actually quite powerful. Let's talk a little bit about content creation, right? So you'd mentioned like, this is what you're doing full time. Even with that, there's so much more you could do, right? You could edit and you could do this. There's just like infinite amount. I think that's why people get so burnt out creating content, because there's always more that you could do. You know, one of the things that I'm thinking about right now is, okay, how do we scale this up, right? So it's working for me. It's working for us as an individual. But like, how do I increase the volume, increase the frequency? And I think one of the biggest challenges is like, I haven't found a way to get other people to help me create interesting content. For some reason, it's just not as good. I don't know. Or maybe I'm just picky. So have you thought about that in terms of how do you start to outsource outside of the production side, some of the actual content itself? And how are you thinking about, as this builds up into more of an organization, what that structure looks like?
I think there are a lot of different ways to think about it. I think people sort of outsource a lot more of it sometimes in the beginning, and sometimes people take a little longer to outsource, and I have barely done any of it because I'm a control freak. But also, for me right now, it does feel kind of manageable. It does feel somewhat manageable to be focused on the main platforms that I'm focused on, the podcast, sometimes TikTok, sometimes Twitter. That feels doable for me right now. And also, I think the way that I'm thinking about going back to this idea of a long game, or how I want to think about this long term, like, I'd like to eventually build sort of like an organization around me that is really bought into the ultimate mission of speaking to this sort of professional, smart, curious woman who is ambitious and wants to learn about all these different things and mainly is interested in these kinds of industries, but also maybe cares about personal development. Like, how can we create all this content that would serve her life and advance her ambitions and her growth? And I think about that. And then when I reverse engineer from that, I always land on, like, anybody I bring in, I really want them to be part of this, like, organization that we're building together, this, like, company that we're building that has that mission, instead of I'm just going to outsource to, you know, all these different random people. There's probably an opportunity still to do a lot more of that than I am, but to me that even feels like a bit of a lift right now, and I'm like, I feel daunted by finding the right agency for that, or the right freelancer, or the right VA in the Philippines for that, so I'm kind of sitting on that a little bit. One thing I will say is I tested out a newsletter and I outsourced the content creation of that to somebody who was really good at it and really understood sort of like what the overall feel we were going for was. So that was really helpful, because the reason I started that Substack is because I wanted to stay top of mind for people, because there are so many podcasts. So sending them a little reminder, hey, here are the episodes we did. Here are the takeaways. If you want to dive in deeper, like, you can listen here. So that was kind of the gist. It was summarizing a lot of what we did on the podcast. But the great thing about that was getting the emails of the people who really, like, are avid listeners of the podcast, because then you know this is where they work, this is what they do, and it's like, oh cool, like, this person listens to my podcast. So that was really helpful, especially when you start to think about, okay, like, sponsorship packages and whatnot, right? So how do I outsource? I don't outsource very much. It's ironic that I'm a short form video creator, because I'm like so verbose that you just have to cut me off.
So you mentioned monetization there, and we'll kind of hit this topic last before a fun end of show question. How does that pie split up for you, and how do you expect that to change over time, right? If your channel continues to grow and you continue to get bigger, what's the big pie, right? Like, in consumer, it's like, hey, I launched Rare Beauty. Rare Beauty is doing $100 million, right? Or I launched my own brand. What does that look like for you, like the big monetization eventually?
Would like for it to be podcast. And when I think about podcast, I think I am in a bit of a place where I'm trying to figure out, do I really want to double down on, like, the business and the D2C and the businessy side of things? Because there are a lot of great business podcasts out there. But I think my TikTok following is a testament to the fact that women also like to consume content from, like, similar voices, women. There aren't a lot of female-led business podcasts out there that are big. So that's one. And then I don't know what this would look like. I actually met Sam Parr recently at LA Tech Week, and I was asking him for advice about this. But I love that they do in-person events, and he was like, they're so hard, they're so difficult, they're not very profitable, but they're worth it. And you should. He was like, you basically have to be an entertainer on stage. And I was like, that sounds horrifying. I changed my mind. And he's like, no, do it. So I would love for there to be this, like, more in-person component, because I already organize a lot of these, like, dinners and events. I love bringing people together in real life. So if the podcast gets to a point where there's a critical mass of this, like, really active, engaged community, how can we bring them together offline, online, and become almost like omni-channel? So I would love to do that. And I don't know what the monetization looks like for that, but that would make me really happy as a creator if I have, like, a robust platform that can do those things in 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I had this really fascinating conversation with a guy named Craig Fuller. So he's a sister portfolio company of ours. And he runs a company called Freight Waves, right? So Freight Waves, and the way it got described to me is like, oh, it's a half software company, like half media business. I'm like, what does that mean? And so I got introduced to him at this dinner and then had such a good conversation with him. Like, I'm flying, they're based in Tennessee. I was like, I'm flying to Chattanooga. Like, I'm going to spend a day and a half with you. Like, I want to understand what this is. And functionally, business is like half Bloomberg Terminal on, like, freight, like trucking and whatever, right? And the other half is like a full editorial business, like covering the industry, covering the whatever. And like 5 or 10% of it will integrate their data, but 90% of it's just like actual, like, serious journalism. And they keep them very separate. They once wrote a piece about the president of their largest customer doing drugs on Snapchat with his son. And like, they did that story about their largest customer, right? Like, that's how separate the two businesses are. But it ends up driving, you know, 90% of their revenue or inbound leads to their software business. And his thesis is that media businesses are incredibly undervalued and under-monetized or incorrectly monetized. And so he did this similarly with, he bought a magazine called Flying Magazine. It's this number one magazine for pilots. He's a private pilot. They made no money. He bought it for super cheap. And then what he did was he like bought 3,000 acres in Tennessee, started a flying community, used the magazine to drive people to that community, bought the lots for $2,000 an acre, resold them for $600,000 an acre. So he's going to make $80 million on this. Long story short. So it's curious for me, thinking of you as a media business, and in a lot of ways, Sam Parr, right? He got bought by HubSpot. They use this media business to drive leads to HubSpot. What would be that monetization path that's different, right? Whether it's buying real estate or it's software or it's whatever, that's much drive significantly more enterprise value than, say, sponsorship or events or whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how terrible media can be as a standalone business model and how lucrative it can be when you actually combine it with different things that have better economics.
Exactly. It's a fascinating concept, right? And so for you, you know, what does that look like? That could be anybody that's marketing to direct-to-consumer brands, anybody, you know, like, what is that? I don't know. It's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's do one fun end of show question. Okay. So what is your next 100-day challenge? And or what's one that you've like, I've always wanted to do this, but it scares me, right? Like, I want to do it. It's like the podcast one, like, or Hard 100 or whatever it is.
Honestly, meditation. Mm. Yeah. I've never been able to get into a meditation practice, which is like additionally embarrassing because I spent 3 years teaching yoga. I was like the least meditated yoga teacher. That's a whole different story. Yeah, I would love to get into a groove there because I also think it's just helpful when you're a content creator to be in a place of more clarity and where you're able to like think clearly and deeply and come up with insights. And I think it's easier to do when your mind isn't, you know, racing in a million directions at once. So I would love to do that. But for me, that actually feels like the hardest one. Like, I would rather do another 100 days of podcasting than sit down to meditate 100 days in a row.
Oh my God, you are a masochist. I cannot imagine like a deeper hell than 100 days of podcasts in a row. Like, I love podcasts, but like my pace is about one a week. That's about the max. One a day, not happening.
Yeah.
Well, I had a great time. I'm so glad we got to know each other and so impressed with your success and excited to see what you continue to do. Excited to work more in the future. Get you at our event.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Awesome. All right. Bye, Dalma.
Bye.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.